This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we go out to Los Angeles to speak with Attorney Jim Lafferty, the head of the National Lawyers Guild out there, on his thoughts on the government shutdown. We'll also discuss international affairs and draw a balance sheet on America's strategy in the Middle East with our discussion with former State Department officer and journalist and author Bill Bloom. Is anyone fighting back against the massive surveillance programs which threaten our democracy? We'll speak with Electronic Frontier Foundation attorney David Green on the lawsuits his organization is handling to protect our privacy.
We'll also hear a presentation from Dr. Harriet Fraud at the Left Forum in New York City.
She's a practicing psychotherapist, and she talks about what life would be like in this country if we didn't have a capitalist system.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Even as we broadcast today's show in New York City, we're in the midst of a draconian government shutdown. We go out to Los Angeles to speak with Jim Lafferty, the attorney who's the head of the National Lawyers Guild out there, for his thoughts on the shutdown. Attorney Jim Lafferty in Los Angeles, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be with you, Mike.
Well, Jim, it's nice to have you on, and I want to acknowledge that your show, the Lawyers Guild show out in Los Angeles on Pacifica affiliate out there, was really inspiration for Heidi and Michael and myself to have Law and Disorder here. So we're very glad to be able to talk to you. Jim, I understand that you've prepared a commentary for your show on the government shutdown, which we're mired in as we speak. And I wanted to ask you if you could please share that commentary with our listeners.
Well, I'd be happy to, sure. Yes, Mike, you know, when the government shut down this week, it really only served to reinforce, in my mind, how I define the government of the United States these days. I see it as a combination oligarchy, banana republic, and third world nation. It's an oligarchy because who governs and how they govern is determined by a relatively small number of corporate giants and billionaires. Yes, unless you happen to be, you know, running for office in one of the few remaining union strongholds, you'd better not drift far from the political line of corporate America if you don't want that same corporate America to fund to the hilt someone with the right politics who will then beat you at the polls. Oh, money may still elect a few true believers, but who are these true believers? Today, most prominent among them, of course, are the Tea Partiers, who were elected to basically get rid of government. The Koch brothers and others of their ilk elected these apostles of no to do precisely what they are doing, making sure no new government programs or government regulations get in the way of the oligarchy as they systematically squeeze every last dime out of the rest of us. Of course, money has determined who gets elected in America for generations. But with the Supreme Court's ruling in the Citizens United case, it's now virtually impossible to defeat big money if big money is determined to defeat you. And that same big money owns the newspapers we read and the television stations we watch, ensuring a rather complete corporatization of life and thought in these United States. We're also pretty much a banana republic because while we may export more than one product, we are now clearly politically unstable and growing more so every day. We have decidedly stratified social classes, including a large and impoverished working class. And we're ruled by a plutocracy or oligarchy comprised of the elites of business, politics, and the military. And certainly, as in any banana republic, the political economic oligarchy controls the primary sector production and thereby severely exploits the nation's economy. And as a consequence of being an oligarchy and a banana republic, we're more and more also a third world country. 40% of our people live below, at, or just above the official poverty line. Our infrastructure is crumbling under our feet and before our eyes. Our public education system, once quite good, is now also in the toilet. Millions of our sisters and brothers are homeless or living in overcrowded substandard housing. Millions are basically now permanently unemployed. In short, you don't have to visit Detroit, my hometown, to find large sections of metropolitan areas or vast portions of rural areas looking like third world countries everywhere. The question, of course, is what is to be done? Well, the full answer to that question is beyond the word limit of this brief commentary. But this much, it seems to me, should be clear to us all by now. So long as we believe capitalist Democrats can save us from capitalist Republicans, we're doomed. So long as we believe fractional measures like the Affordable Care Act are going to help solve the big problems facing this nation, we are doomed. So long as we sit still for draconian government spying and laws like the Military Authorization Act that allow the military to pick us up off the street and hold us indefinitely without charge or a trial or even recourse to a lawyer, we are doomed. So long as we allow the government to use our own tax dollars to bail out the very banks that are now throwing us out of our homes, we are doomed. So long as we allow undeclared, unconstitutional foreign wars of exploitation to be fought in our name, we are doomed. And so long as we allow corporate profits to trump controls on greenhouse gas emissions that will surely destroy the only planet we can live on, we are doomed big time. In short, so long as we cling to the belief that we live in a true democracy and can find peace and social and economic justice in this capitalist society, we are doomed. So, friends, if ever a time demanded new thinking and new forms of political action, if ever a time demanded we give up the old myths that simply serve to numb us out so that those who rule our lives can do so without our interference, it's now. And Mike, as you well know, the Lawyers Guild show in Los Angeles and the Law and Disorder show in New York City are dedicated to helping us understand how to do just that.
I'm Michael Ratner, and I want to interrupt this program to bring you an incredibly important update. It concerns Jeremy Hammond, the hacktivist who admitted to hacking into the global private intelligence company Stratford and hacking into some 5 million emails. Jeremy Hammond pled guilty to one count under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, a conspiracy that can give him a maximum of 10 years in prison. He faced his sentence on November 15th in a New York City federal court. But here is what Jeremy and others need you to do. You must, I implore you, to send letters of support for Jeremy Hammond that can be used at his upcoming sentencing. The reason I'm imploring you so dramatically at this moment is those letters must be submitted to the Lawyers for Jeremy Hammond by October 15th. That's right, in a week, by October 15th. It's not hard to do. I'm going to give you a site for a template you can go to. It explains what you can say, gives you some ideas, and also gives you a place you can email or fax the letters. The website is freejeremy.net. That's freejeremy.net. Go to that website, look at the template of instructions for the letters, write the letter, send it to the lawyers. The address is on there. This is very important. The lawyers believe that Jeremy should get no more than time served in this case. He's already been in federal prison for 2 years. Let's make this sentencing the end of his time in prison. Go to the website freejeremy.net and by October 15th, compose and send a letter to Jeremy's lawyers so that it can help him achieve what his lawyers believe should happen here, which is a maximum of time served and not 10 years in prison. We'll have more on this next week, but I want to also say that the Stratford emails continue to be disclosed by WikiLeaks with many revelations, and they will continue probably for months, if not years, to come as those documents are analyzed. Jeremy's work was very important here, so I again stress, help Jeremy Hammond, help him ensure that he will get no more than time served. Thank you.
President Barack Obama addressed the 68th session of the United Nations General Assembly at the end of September. His speech reflected some of the shift in global politics in the Middle East, especially in Syria and Iran. We get a perspective on American strategy in those countries and the Middle East today with our discussion with Bill Bloom. Bill was a State Department officer before he quit and has been a freelance journalist in the United States. His book on U.S. foreign policy, Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Intervention Since World War II, first published in 1995 and updated ever since, has received international acclaim. Bill, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Michael. Thank you very much.
Well, it's nice to talk to you again. I wanted to set the stage for our interview by observing that this is the 12th anniversary of the United States war against Afghanistan. The United States has been at war in Iraq for 10 years. In the interim, the United States helped overthrow the government of Libya. It's at war in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia. Just last week, we heard threats from President Obama and the head of Israel, Netanyahu, against Iran. And I wanted to go back, Bill, and ask you to talk about the beginning of all this, it seems to me, back 57 years ago, when the United States overthrew the democratically elected Mossadegh government in Iran. Why'd they do that, and what's been their strategic policy ever since?
Well, to understand U.S. foreign policy, I've long maintained, one must understand and accept the basic premise that the United States wants to dominate the world. And in that context, it becomes clear that the only problem that we have with other countries, well, the main problem is one of disobedience. As long as a country is willing to become a good client state of Washington and do their part in the Cold War or the War on Terror or whatever, as long as they do that, it doesn't matter how bad, quote-unquote, the country is. Our closest ally in the Arab world is Saudi Arabia. If not the most oppressive government in the world, then damn close to it. So we don't care about such things. We have overthrown the three leading secular governments of the Middle East. First, Iraq, and then Libya, and now we're in the process of attempting to overthrow the Syrian government. These are with these, the three leading secular governments, and they all ran, especially Iraq and Libya, ran welfare states. That's all gone now. So we don't care about anything else. Iran, its crime back in 1953 was to nationalize the major oil companies of the UK, which later formed as BP. Iran nationalized them, and they wouldn't listen to the threats and the arguments of London and Washington, and so there was no choice for the Western powers to overthrow them, which they did through a fairly nonviolent coup d'etat. And then that put into power the Shah, and he ruled for 26 years with torture as one of his main tools of governance. In 79, he was overthrown by various forces, but the ones that came to power were the Islamics. Now, it's a myth that the U.S. was totally opposed to Islam coming to power in Iran then. What the U.S. was looking for, once it was clear that the Shah could no longer stay in power, besides him dying of cancer, once it was clear that he had to be replaced, the choice made by Washington was the Islamics. This is not to say that Iran is a threat to Israel, but Israel fears Iran the same way it feared Iraq and Libya. And any country in the Middle East which had some military power and which was not falling in line as an obedient follower or friend of Israel, that was targeted by Israel, which means targeted by the U.S. So the three main targets have all been attacked by Washington, and that's where we are today.
On the question of nationalization, when the Iranians nationalized what was now known as British Petroleum, the people that polluted the Gulf of Mexico, when the Iranian government was overthrown for nationalizing the oil companies there, it's true, isn't it, that a country has the legal right to nationalize its own property? And that's something that should be allowed. And wasn't that the same trigger for the United States' hostility towards Cuba when they nationalized American interests in Cuba? They offered to pay for them, but that wasn't enough because Cuba was showing disobedience.
Yeah. The oil issue with Cuba was not an important thing, or their nationalization. Cuba, then and now, for 50 years, has represented what Washington fears greatly, a good example of an alternative to the capitalist system. That's the danger Cuba has long represented, and that's why it's been punished so severely. And they have been exactly that. They have a good example of an alternative to capitalism. They have inspired countries and people all over the world, especially in Latin America. And so Washington's fear from their own narrow point of view was justified. And that's not quite the same as with Iran.
Well, let's get back to Iran's neighbor, Afghanistan. You make the point that the United States doesn't really fear these Islamic regimes. And I was thinking of the United States overthrowing a reform regime in Afghanistan and supporting the Taliban, creating it.
And it's not very well known amongst Americans and amongst American media, or it's never mentioned at least, that from the late 70s until throughout the 1980s, Afghanistan had a fairly progressive government. Women had full rights. I've seen photos of that time with women walking around in miniskirts. There was so much freedom for women and other groups in that period that the Pentagon put out a book in which it discussed all the advances in freedom, and I've quoted from this. The book is available in libraries. I've quoted the passages the Pentagon has used to extol the kind of society that there was then. And what happened to that society and that government? Our dear government overthrew it. So it's amazing when we hear about people saying things like, we have to remain in Afghanistan to help the women there. They're so oppressed. If we leave, the women will be even worse off. Well, that may be true, but if we hadn't interfered in the first place, the women would have been in a much better position. So that's a piece of forgotten history.
And let's talk about another neighboring state, Iraq. That society has been devastated now. But what was it like there before the United States launched their shock and awe program? What was the purpose of it?
Well, the purpose of it was to destroy Iraq's military capability and overthrow Saddam Hussein. The same as with Libya and the same as with Syria. Removing any barrier to U.S. and or Israeli dominance of the Middle East. That's the key to this. And then with Iraq, there was also the question of oil, of course. So that's the end of the secular governments of the Middle East. Saddam Hussein, as much of a dictator as he was, he still ran a welfare state. The people in their daily living, in their daily life, were much better off than they are today. And there was peace and order. Today, it's a horrible nightmare. So there's nothing positive one can say about the changes to Iraq as a result of the U.S. occupation and invasion.
What do you make of the United States' aims against the Syrian government?
Well, it's part of the same pattern, partly because Syria is makes it very plain and has for years that it's not going to be a good client state of the U.S. or of Israel. And Syria also is a bit too friendly with Russia, The Cold War still lingers there. We can't tolerate such people. It's amazing how sensitive we are to anybody who will not fully embrace the American Empire. And it takes a brave person to stand up to the Empire, but no matter how brave they are, they can't deal with the unlimited power of the U.S. military. So eventually, they all succumb.
What do you make of Obama and Netanyahu keeping sanctions against Iran and threatening Iran, and at the same time appearing to change a bit American policy towards Iran?
I've written about this. There are many leading figures in Israel who have publicly admitted that they don't believe that Iran is a threat. And in fact, almost all the leading people of Israel, except for Netanyahu, they will agree with this. They know that Iran is not a threat. This is all hype. But Netanyahu, he needs this hype, and the U.S. needs it. And I've also written about U.S. leaders who have said publicly that they don't think that Iran is a threat. But that stuff is always buried. It was most prominent under the previous president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He was accused of two major crimes. One, he denied the Holocaust had taken place, and two, he had threatened to wipe Israel off the map, quote-unquote. Those two lies have been used 1,000 times by Israel and the U.S. and by conservatives all over the world, and they are both lies. Israel has finally admitted officially a couple of years ago there was no such threat made to wipe Israel off the map. I don't know if that's been mentioned yet in the American media, but that was always a myth, and he never questioned the Holocaust. That's also a big myth. And I quote from a talk he gave at Columbia University in New York in 2007, where he says explicitly that that is not his belief, that the Holocaust did not exist. This quote was in the Washington Post. But it's amazing how things are not learned by the American media and the American people. They have to be told again and again, which is why in my monthly anti-empire report, I repeat these things again and again. I don't enjoy doing that, but people forget.
We're speaking with Bill Bloom in Washington, D.C., about American foreign policy in the Middle East, and particularly about Iran. Bill, I wanted to ask you about another, what I would characterize as a lie, but ask you about it, that Iran is trying to get nuclear weapons and is therefore a threat to Israel and the United States. What do you make of that story?
I don't think that Israeli leaders or American leaders really believe that. I've quoted several of them saying that they don't believe that. And even if Iran did have nuclear weapons, what reason in the world would they have to use them against Israel or the U.S.? They know very well this would mean instant, total annihilation of Iran. How could they avoid that? If they would use a nuclear weapon against Israel or the U.S., that would be the end of Iran, the end of Persia of thousands of years ago. So there's no reason to fear this, even if they had such weapons. But Israel wants to be the only nuclear power in the Middle East. They love that being in that position, and the U.S. loves it also. So that's why they want to make sure that Iran doesn't have such weapons, even if they know very well that there's no threat to them.
Well, isn't it true that Iran has signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Pact and that there are monitors on their enrichment program, that what they're doing is trying to develop nuclear power for peaceful means, and that they've issued fatwas, which are definitions of Islamic law, saying that nuclear weapons are a sin in their religion. But that is never spoken about in the American media, is it?
Well, no, that's mentioned somewhere at the end of some article. It's not in headlines, of course, but people who are not just intoxicated with American imperialism or with Zionist power, they know very well that Iran is no threat when it comes to nuclear weapons. So we have to keep that in mind when we hear the talks given by Obama and Netanyahu and people like that. They know that what they're saying is a bunch of baloney.
What about Israel's nuclear weapons? That seems to me to be an open secret in the world, but you don't read much about it in the United States.
Yeah, I think I read that in the past year or two, there was some from a high level in Israel, the admittance that they have these weapons. I think that was the first time. I can't cite you the exact details, but in the past 2 years, there was finally an admittance by some high Israeli official as to that.
So what do you believe is the aim of current American policy with respect to Iran? Obama said they're not interested in regime change.
Of course they are, and in Syria as well. He's lying. There's no other purpose. That is the reason. We don't want anyone in power, especially in a place like the Middle East, which doesn't offer enough measure of subservience to Washington's policies and to Israel. That's a simple bottom line.
Yeah, I like your formulation, enough measure of subservience, because there are other leaders around the world that the United States has overthrown. I'm thinking of Panama or Saddam Hussein, the head of the Libyan government, all of whom have attempted to work with the United States, but nonetheless got overthrown.
Yeah, well, but the U.S. always knew that the likes of Gaddafi and Saddam were not really subservient. Gaddafi came to power by overthrowing a monarchy and closing down American military bases in Libya. That set the pattern, the model. And from that point on, the U.S. knew that this man was not one of them. And that was never forgiven.
And they bombed Libya, although refused to call that an act of war.
They bombed Libya a few times in the 80s, yeah.
And that was done under the rubric of humanitarian intervention. And I want to ask you about that.
Well, that's what we call it now. What else are we going to call it? we're attacking them because they don't want to be our slaves. They have to find some kind of platitude, some kind of euphemism. That's the favorite euphemism of the past 20 years as a humanitarian intervention.
And what was your take on the allegations that the Syrian government used chemical weapons against its own population? That was the possible pretext for
right.
American bombing of Syria. Do you think that the United States is training troops or supplying weapons to the so-called rebels in Syria in an attempt to overthrow the Assad government?
Oh, yeah. If not always directly, then indirectly. The two major suppliers of arms to the Syrian rebels are Qatar and Saudi Arabia, who get their arms from guess where? From Washington. And Turkey also gets plenty of arms from Washington. These three countries, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, can easily supply the military needs of the rebels.
So let's draw a balance sheet, Bill Bloom. We've got the government of Afghanistan overthrown. We've got the government of Iraq overthrown. We've got the government of Libya overthrown. And we have currently attempts to overthrow the governments of both Syria and Iran.
And maybe Yemen and well, I was going to say Somalia, but they have their passes for a government, yeah.
If the United States accomplishes that, and says that that's in our national interests. Can you define for us what they say is our national interest and what somebody like yourself or I would believe is a national interest?
There's a very growing trend now to be turned off by all these wars. The vote in Congress, which would have been, if it had been held, would easily have been against invading Syria. And the American public, the polls show a huge portion in, against any war in Syria. The American public is very tired of these wars.
I think that that's a very fine point to end this interview, Bill Bloom. And I wanted to thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. But before I say goodbye to you, tell people how they can get your anti-empire report.
Okay, they can go to my website, which is William Bloom, that's B-L-U-M, williambloom.org, and they can sign up for the monthly anti-empire report, and they can read about all of my books and even buy them if they want.
Well, I can tell you that when Michael Ratner and I wrote our book about the assassination of Che Guevara, which was accomplished by the United States, by the CIA, we relied heavily on your book, Killing Hope. And I'm a faithful reader of your anti-empire report, Bill Bloom. And I thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
What legal steps are being taken to stem the pervasive breach of our civil liberties, particularly the Fourth Amendment guarantee to the right of privacy, which is being performed by the mammoth National Security Agency's surveillance program? Our own Heidi Boghossian wrote the book Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. She discussed in detail the public fight back from a legal standpoint. Today, attorney David Green, a senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, brings us up to date about ongoing litigation, lawsuits, and Freedom of Information Act requests to continue the fight back against government and corporate spying. David Green, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Good to be here.
David, there's just been a cascade of information coming out, particularly since the Snowden revelations about what the government is doing to what our co-host Heidi Boghossian calls spying on democracy. You're in a particularly good position to help our listeners understand just what their government's capacity is, what they can find out about us, what they know, and what kind of information we have up to date, what is, in my view, a real threat to a democratic government.
Well, you know, and the challenge that we're learning a little bit more with every disclosure, we're learning a little bit more about how much they do know. And so there's a lot we still don't know about how much they know about us. But let's talk about what we do know. We do know that they have several programs that collect communications data. They have a program that's called Upstream, which actually collects all internet communications. This actually happens at the fiber level, where in the communications companies switching facilities, there's actually a splitter that splits the transmission into what the communications company wants it to go, and then one that actually goes towards the government. So we've known about that program actually for several years, and we here at EFF have had a few lawsuits pending about that for almost 7 years now, our original lawsuit was actually against AT&T, but then Congress granted the telecom providers immunity, so we have a lawsuit pending against the government. One of the other things we've learned about is another program that also collects internet records called PRISM. PRISM seems to be focused on collecting email correspondence between foreign targets and the United States. And this is all done under the context of Section 702, which allows collection of data regarding foreign targets.
So, is that 702 of the Patriot Act?
Yes. So this is what we know about that. That's collecting internet data. Some of the recent things we found out also is about this collection of what the government called bulk telephone records. And these bulk telephone records are collected under a different provision of the Patriot Act, Section 215, which is also known as the business records provision. And what they're collecting, and they're basically collecting the call data of every telephone call made in the United States. And right now they're saying they're not collecting the content of these calls, only what they're calling the metadata, which is the which number calls which other number, what time that call was made, how long it lasted, information like that. But not the contents of the call. They say they're not collecting the contents of the call. So that's some of it. We also, now the most recent disclosures, and we're still trying to piece this together here, is that they're also collecting social media data as well, and doing things like social mapping and contact chaining, all sorts of stuff like that to try and get some sense of who's communicating with who. That seems to be what we know right now based on some of the more recent disclosures.
One thing that scares me about this question, when they say, we're just collecting the megadata and not the real content of my phone call, is that they're building this huge 100,000-square-foot facility in Bluffdale, Utah. 100,000 square feet, that's like 10,000 rooms in an apartment. So I think that they're planning to store not just the metadata, but the content of my phone calls. Would that be a fair assumption?
Well, they've denied doing that, and frankly, they have plenty of data to fill a large facility, even with what they're getting. What they're saying is that they don't have that they aren't seeking and haven't acquired, and we don't have any proof that they've acquired the content of the calls. There hasn't been any documents disclosed either by Snowden or otherwise that they're acquiring the content of the calls, as opposed to the upstream program with the email traffic where where it's getting everything. And they're also saying they don't even look at the vast majority of the telephone metadata. And I agree. I don't like calling it metadata, simply data about data. I don't like calling it that because you actually can learn quite a lot about when you know who somebody calls and how often they call that person.
And where they called them from.
And where they called
them. The old joke is that the cell phone is really a locating device that also serves as a phone.
Yeah, and one of the things that we don't know, again, that hasn't been cleared, they've denied that they are collecting cell location data, but it seems it would be hard for them to segregate the cell location data from the other information.
Yeah, precisely. So we know that in New York City, for example, there are surveillance cameras everywhere. We know they're developing biometric systems so they can identify people. And they're tracking our emails. They've got this data on our cell phones. So let's talk about how this impacts on the Fourth Amendment. Tell our audience what the Fourth Amendment is, what it was designed to do, and what the threat is to democracy with respect to it.
Right. Well, there are several provisions of the Fourth Amendment. The one that we're most at issue here is the idea that is the prohibition against unreasonable searches and seizures without a warrant. Under the law is that there are constitutional standards about when a search warrant is issued and when a warrant is required for the government to collect information. We believe this records collection program that is going on through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, all these programs that are being disclosed, we believe they don't comply with Fourth Amendment standards, that basically people's information is being searched, is being seized without a showing of probable cause, any probable cause to believe that these people actually did anything wrong.
We're speaking with David Green. David, tell us a little bit about the organization you work for and what you're trying to accomplish.
Well, Electronic Frontier Foundation is a nonprofit organization that fights for civil liberties in the digital world and the digital environment. We do lots of things here at ENF, but one of the things we're doing is working on challenging the constitutionality and the legality of the surveillance programs. And we've had litigation pending against the government. We've had several cases going for several years now regarding the upstream program and the prison program, and we actually have filed a new lawsuit now regarding this telephone records collection program. That's just getting going.
How does your organization stack up to the NSA? The NSA spends, I've read, $10.8 billion a year to conduct this spying on democracy. How about the EFF? Is this truly a David and Goliath fight?
Yeah, we don't have a $10 billion budget here. So whenever you go up against the government, you're going to be out-resourced. That's just the way it works. And you even most private law firms and corporate entities are going to be out-resourced litigating against the government. So I guess in some ways you can consider it a David and Goliath.
But what are the stakes here, David? Orwell, I think we would agree, would be amazed at the capacity that the government has to invade people's privacy. And Hannah Arendt wrote that landmark book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, and she defined totalitarianism as the ability of a government to destroy any kind of private organizations. So there was no privacy left. There was no independent organizations that could get themselves elected and have control over the government, that in fact, what you have is democracy standing on its head, where instead of having a representative government, you have a government that's running the people. And is that the direction you see things going in? Is this kind of massive collection of data a threat to activists in this country that are trying to do stuff for social change?
Well, the way I see it, and this is actually an argument we're making in our lawsuit, is that there's a First Amendment right, and a very important First Amendment right, to associate with other people for activism purposes, for communication purposes, for social purposes. And that's a very important right, and I think that's an essential element of freedom, part of our individual autonomy that upon which our democratic system is based. That right is infringed when the fact of your associations is disclosed, that there are many parts about being a free person that requires a person to be able to operate with some degree of privacy from their government. And to me, that's what I see these programs being the biggest threat.
It's alarming to me that alongside the development of a $10.8 billion a year NSA that can do all the things you've just educate us about, you have a militarization of the police forces across the country. You have them armed to the teeth now. Now we're going into the sixth year of an economic crisis, the worst since the Depression, and you're starting to see some fight back. You had 2 years ago Occupy Wall Street, and you have continual unrest now. And how do you see that relating to what you've been telling us about spying on democracy?
I can't speak to sort of the military buildup of the police, but I think what we're seeing is the threat of terrorism, the fear of a domestic terrorism attack, really driving a lot of incursions on our freedoms that I don't think anyone would have tolerated 13 years ago. It's just changed, and I think people really have to think about what type of society do they want to live in. I hear a lot of people say things like, well, I have nothing to hide, so why should I care if they're collecting my data? And, you know, I guess I just disagree. It's not the question is not whether I have something to hide. The question is, what's my relationship with my government? And to me, being a free person means having a relationship with my government where I have a degree of privacy over what I do, and it's none of the government's business about what I do. It doesn't mean that only people who are engaging in subversive activities have to feel that way. To me, it's just part of being a free person. And I do think that that's at least a question everyone has to ask themselves when they learn about these programs.
And these programs have gotten so much terrible traction because of the fear of terrorism that's been galloping since 9/11. What's your assessment about the reality of this all-pervasive terrorism? Do you think the government hypes that threat?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely beyond my expertise. But what we have seen is when we've questioned the efficacy of these programs is that the examples that the government is pointing to where the collection of this data has actually been used to prevent a terrorist attack are really very insubstantial.
Yeah, that's been my observation also. Here in New York, for example, last week we had a lawsuit going forward where it's been shown that the New York City Police Department covers the Muslim community in our city like a blanket. You've got people in the restaurants, in the barbershops, in the mosques. And despite this huge program to sniff out terrorism amongst the Muslim community, they haven't gotten one lead out of it. Do you think that this spying on democracy has any kind of a negative effect on people's activism?
I certainly think it infringes on people's associational rights. And we've talked to many groups who have said that they feel that the fact that they cannot guarantee secrecy of their communications is harming their ability to do the work they do. Some people operate hotlines, where people they used to be able to tell people that they could call them anonymously and they would not disclose the information to anybody. Again, we're not just hearing stories just from the left. Some of the plaintiffs in our lawsuit now are gun rights organizations. They consider themselves to be a dissident organization, especially in California, where gun rights might not be as popular in other parts of the country. And they're finding it very difficult to engage with their constituents in the way they want to because they can no longer guarantee them anonymity.
If people want to learn more about the Electronic Frontier Foundation, how do people get in touch with you?
Yeah, go to our website, EFF.org. There's a lot of information there. We really try and report very fully on all the work that we do and keep our website very current. There's lots of information there.
Do you have any kind of public programs or a presence outside of the internet?
We contribute speakers to other people's programs, and we write a lot and everything. And occasionally we do our own programming, although it's not our primary function as an organization. So.
And where are you headquartered, David?
We are located in San Francisco.
Yeah, Heidi Bogosian's out there this week doing a program.
I think she might be like a block away from us right now.
Great. David Green from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. We'll keep up with you, and we would like you to come back on again.
Oh, great. I'm happy to come back. Thanks so much.
Take it easy.
Okay. Bye.
We go now to a speech given by Dr. Harriet Fraud, a psychotherapist in New York City, at the June 9th Left Forum panel. Dr. Fraud's speech is about what personal relations would be like in America if we weren't living under a capitalist system. Fraud is a practicing psychotherapist in New York City and a longtime activist in progressive social movements. Let's have a listen.
Imagine mass media full of stories of regular working people celebrating our deeds, our work, our lifestyle, our relationships. Imagine eliminating capitalist profits to our health. Imagine the relief we'd have being taught a healthy lifestyle to protect us from the scourges of such profit, such as obesity, heart disease, diabetes, and asthma. Imagine healthy food being promoted instead of junk food. Imagine affordable working class restaurants with playgrounds as available as McDonald's and serving quality food. Imagine the level of asthma that would go down if pollutants were taken out of our care. Imagine getting sick without worry about money. Imagine knowing that whatever research is behind the medical products we consume, and certainly psych is among them, was not done by the same companies that profited from them, but rather by independent research. Imagine knowing that our caregivers weren't paid extra for prescribing known drugs with side effects or medical devices. Imagine them not getting kickbacks. Imagine that when we're sick, We go to a doctor who knows us, who takes the time, who can imagine how and why we got sick and help. Cuba's poor, but they have 23 times less that they have to pay in healthcare costs, and their infant mortality rates are lower. We have the costliest medical system in the world that provides inferior care. The supports that hold us up psychologically, because I'm talking about relationships and personal life, are like a four-legged chair. One leg is personal life with an intimate circle that may be a partner and others, deep friends, children, or family. A second leg of our mental health is a wider circle of people who provide a set of connections around a shared interest or activity. Could be a PTA, could be a blood drive, could be a political party. It could be a church. A third leg of our mental health seat is a sense of hope and security, which this book is trying to build, thanks to Francis and Michael and Debbie Smith. A sense of hope and security built on opportunities for a secure livelihood, chances to improve one's own life, and hope for the future. A fourth leg supporting us is a sense of hope and security that comes when we basically trust each other. The United States is the highest on the distrust indices of all the developed nations. That can happen in an egalitarian society where people assume we're all in this together as equals. Right now, all four chairs of American support are now wobbling. On the social support now, Americans are the most socially isolated of all developed people. There are fewer Americans doing anything like a social connection, blood drive, PTA, sports team, than the number that were in bowling leagues alone in 1970. A quarter of Americans have no one to talk to, even in the worst emergencies. People can, if they own a computer, connect on the internet, where they may honestly or falsely present themselves, and they can never get a hug. On a personal, intimate level, we have the highest formal legal divorce rate in the world, which doesn't count all those people who separate without legal costs. On the wider front, hope is hard to muster. If we, like Denmark or a poorer country like Estonia, provided more than 6 months of paid leave for new parents, life would be a lot easier. What if we could all afford relaxation at home rather than just wealthy Americans who can relieve the burden of domestic work by hiring poorer women for nanny care, for maid service, for food preparation, for laundry? Imagine if we all could come home from work and relax, be with whoever we feel like connecting to closely. For most adults, marriage has been the basis of emotional life. Now, stable marriages are finished, and there are no alternatives out there. It's true in divorce and separation, women suffer more economically, whereas men suffer more emotionally. Women retain close bonds with each other and children, while men have a hard and lonely time. The logic of capitalist profit lowered men's wages. As soon as computers and multinational communication system allowed them to export jobs to cheaper places and more exploited workers, the crisis of lowered wages pushed women into the labor force to support themselves and their families and altered the whole fabric of personal support. That was really led by Ronald Reagan, the family values president, who attacked unions first at PATCO and then at the postal unit, the postal workers unit of 300,000 strong, from which the mass murder title Going Postal emerged. It ensured the profits of the 20% of Americans who own 80% of America. American women and families should have been given and were not given the social supports to work outside the home and in it and create time together. Capitalism's reach stretches from the boardroom into the bedroom. The transformations in women's increased work as bread earners and men's increasingly lost dominant roles have been a golden opportunity for capitalist exploitation of men's lost possibilities of dominance. The pornography industry has burgeoned, and it particularly in the hetero pornography industry, which has burgeoned the most, it panders to men's lost sexual domination and women's sexual humiliation. The gay porn industry is much more of an egalitarian romp. The wide promulgation of internet porn in the early 90s with its explosion of profits was and still is a capitalist dream machine. Imagine a life without capitalist efficiency. Imagine stable jobs and vacation time for personal and political activities and relationships. Imagine the empowerment of democracy at work. Imagine the high quality of universal childcare, health care and education, including sex education and education in religion, in relationship building. And of course America can afford it. Imagine using the vast funds given for the highly profitable corporate and military subsidies. Imagine how we could nurture ourselves with the $78 trillion, $155 billion that have subsidized the private U.S. oil and gas industries between 2011 and will until 2015. Unless, of course, a revolutionary mass changes that. Imagine how the $1.29 trillion given to the U.S. military for the the disasters in Iraq and Afghanistan could be used instead to create jobs with time and benefits to nurture one another and children. Imagine a sturdy four-legged seat of personal, social, societal support and trust. Capitalist exploitation has invaded even our most intimate sexual activities with its porn of humiliation of women. These things are so possible. They're possible in Scandinavia. They're possible here. This is a mere beginning of the imagination we need to envision and then to realize emotional, relational, sexual, egalitarian, socialist America. It's possible.
You want to hear Law and Disorder again? Go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.